This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Jim McKelvey wrote a computer science textbook at age 18, co-founded a glass art studio and gallery, and founded companies in the fields of CD cabinet making, software, book printing, roofing, and payments. His best-known success is Square, now called Block, the company that changed the credit card processing landscape. McKelvey and co-founder Jack Dorsey, Twitter's former CEO, co-founded Block in 2009. 6 years later, it raised $243 million in an IPO that gave it a valuation of nearly $3 billion. And today, it has tens of millions of customers around the world. Jim, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thank you, Kathleen. This is going to be fun.
You weren't in the cool crowd in high school, an experience you say trained you.
What do you mean in high school? Like, when did I get in the cool crowd?
Well, you
nice
have
qualifier to... there.
But you have such a good answer for it. You know, you say not being in the cool crowd trained you to be an entrepreneur. How come?
I didn't get a lot of positive feedback for the things that I was doing. And I learned at some point to live without it. And I think entrepreneurs are going to be much better served if they are not expecting positive feedback from experiments and new things. So I use the word entrepreneur very specifically to talk about somebody who's doing something that hasn't been done before and certainly hasn't been perfected and is probably not going to work the first time. So I think it's a good training if you don't expect positive feedback, which I have not always gotten a lot of positive feedback.
You know, I feel most motivated when I get negative feedback, I guess.
I think so. I mean, it, you know, but probably a lot of that motivation is just, you know, being pissed off, right? I'll show you, you know, but hey, look, whatever the source of the energy, that's good. I mean, if your motivations are anger, I certainly wouldn't criticize you because I think a lot of the things that motivate me are things that make me angry.
Fair enough. You were an art glass blower with a national reputation for your bowls when you came up with the idea for Square. Tell us about how that happened.
So Jack Dorsey and I have been friends and business colleagues for years. He used to work for me when he was 15. He came to work on his bicycle. And we have, you know, had this sort of on again, off again relationship where, you know, we get together and do stuff and then we split apart and don't do stuff and then we get back together. So Jack had recently been kicked out of Twitter for the first time. And he was looking for something to do. And he asked me if I wanted to start a company with him. And I was like, yeah, sure. What do you want to do? And he had no idea. And I was like, well, I don't know. What do you want to do? So we were sort of casting around for ideas. And I was in my glass studio trying to sell a piece of glass to a lady who had an American Express card, but only an American Express card. And we don't take Amex at my studio. So I lost that sale. And it was a big sale of a really ugly piece of glass that had been sitting on the shelf for years. And I desperately wanted to get rid of this thing. And I failed. But it angered me. And while that anger was still, you know, sort of hot in my head, I called Jack and I said, hey, man, I think I know what we want to do. Like, I want to build something so I don't lose any more sales. So that was the genesis of Square, which is now called Block. But it is it's a very personal story because if you've ever lost a sale because you couldn't take the money that somebody wanted to give you in the form that they wanted to give it to you, you'll know how very frustrating that is.
So you started Block. It's funny calling it Block, isn't it?
It is. I'm still getting used to it, even though I voted on the name change.
So you started Square, now called Block. And you figured out the first day you were sitting there and you figured out that you were violating all kinds of government and banking regulations.
Day 17 one. Total rules and regulations. On the first day I discovered, I stopped counting at 17. I'm not quite sure what the total is, but at 17 I started, you know, I basically gave up tallying the things that we were doing in violation of the rules. And we didn't really want to break those rules. We just wanted to build a certain type of product. And we thought, well, why couldn't you build this? And it turns out there are a bunch of reasons why you can't do that. There are reasons why the banking world made you sign physical pieces of paper as opposed to, you know, clicking an agreement online. There are reasons they made you sign up with social security numbers and lots of background checks and all this other stuff that we thought was unnecessary. So we ended up basically ignoring those rules, we built our product. And then once we had our product working, we went around and either made our product compliant with the rules, or in some cases, we had to get the rules changed.
It's interesting that you gave up counting the rules you were breaking, but you persevered with the company. What made you persevere?
Well, it was a sort of a golden moment because we were asking ourselves what we wanted to build seemed very simple and obvious to us. So why doesn't this exist? Why doesn't this exist? And the first thing I always do when I come up with an idea is I assume somebody else smarter than me and older than me had the idea previously. So I always go looking for the guy who had the idea, you know, 5 years ago and see what happened to him. So that spirit was there at Square, and I couldn't find anybody who had built what we were trying to build. And I thought, well, this seems so obvious. This seems like what everybody would want. Why has nobody built this? And then halfway through the first day, I was like, oh, there are rules to prevent this. And so we had this very quick meeting. Jack and I decided that we would build it anyway, and that the fact that there were rules that we were breaking was actually a good sign, because it meant that it explained why we had the field to ourselves.
So let's talk about what's different about it. Everyone knows Square is the little white square that you put on your iPad or something and you process a credit card. Why was that different from going into a store and having them process your credit card?
Well, in our world, it didn't seem like it should be, but we wanted the sign-up process to be super easy. We wanted there to be no contracts. We wanted there to be full and free refunds. We wanted to change the pricing of the industry. Probably the best example of something that we thought was terrible was the way credit card processing was priced at the time, because nobody knew what a card would cost. And there were these Byzantine formulas that would dictate the amount of money that a merchant paid per transaction. And that varied based on how many transactions, when the transactions were, the type of cards presented, the type of merchandise sold, the type of way the merchant would submit the merchandise, whether or not it was card present or card not present. There were like 300 variables. This insanely complicated question that nobody could answer, which is, how much am I paying for this transaction? And we thought, well, that's stupid. You should know. Like, if you're a merchant, why don't we just tell you what it's going to cost? So we did. The problem was, we didn't know ourselves. We were just putting our balance sheet in front of the transaction, and we would, in many cases, lose money. So if it was a very small transaction, like under $5, Square would lose money on the transaction. But we decided to do that just to keep the system fair and understandable for all our clients.
What you figured out going in was that the smaller businesses were paying, what do you figure out, like 45 times more in fees?
Yes. Wow, you've got a great recollection for numbers. That is exactly how much more a small business was paying than a large business when it came to processing fees with credit cards.
And you fixed that.
We fixed it, yeah. We fixed it by basically becoming a large company ourselves. We put all the little guys together in this big group we called Square, and then we went and negotiated and brought a lot of efficiency to the lower end of the market.
Fixing a big problem is one of the important things for entrepreneurs, you say.
I think it's a great way to focus. So if you think about what you would do if you weren't focused on a problem, you'd probably be focused on an opportunity. And a lot of people like to be, you know, focused on opportunities. What are the opportunities? You know, what's the opportunity with NFT? There's there are NFT opportunities. And I look at it differently. I say, well, what is my problem? And what do I need to solve that problem? And if I need non-fungible tokens to solve that problem, then fine, I'll use an NFT. But if I don't, why do I care? So the easy thing about problems, at least for me, is that they're easy to see. So for instance, I know there's a lot of opportunity in the crypto space right now. I don't really know exactly what that is in many cases. So I don't sit there and get all excited about crypto. Now, sometimes I'll look at trying to build something and I'll say, wow, I wish I had this thing that I could easily move between countries and, you know, from country to country without governments regulating me. And crypto is that thing. So I'll use it then.
Someone with a technology degree who doesn't get all wrapped up in the technology, focuses on the problem, lesson learned.
So I always assume the technology. The way I approach it is I always assume it exists and I just have to find it. Now, sometimes I can't. So for instance, right now I'm doing some basic chemistry research. I'm trying to make a biodegradable super absorbent. So we've got a bunch of things that are polluting the world. And I think if we had a biodegradable thing that was able to replace plastic, it would be good. So I'm doing basic research on that. But the only reason I'm doing that is because nobody's fixed that chemistry so far. So I want to do something. Well,
I appreciate you're trying to fix the media too. You know, tell us about your latest startup, St. Louis-based Invisibly.
Invisibly. Ah, yes. So Invisibly is an effort to let people take control of how their eyeballs are being bought and sold. So if you don't think you are being bought and sold, any moment you are in a quote unquote free system like Facebook or, you know, even Google or certainly Instagram and all of those platforms are basically using you as the product and your attention is being bought and sold to advertisers. And in exchange for that, they give you something you kind of want, which is, you know, connections to your friends or maybe some news articles or stuff like that. But the entire transaction is run for the benefit of the platform, not the person. And because of that, there are some weird and bad things. One of the weird things is that the platforms profit from pissing you off. So a platform will sit there and say, oh, well, let's watch Kathleen. She's playing, she's reading. Oh, she's about to leave. Hey, if we show her this article that we know will just inflame her, she's likely to stay on for another 15 minutes. Well, the algorithms have figured out what is likely to upset you, and they're perfectly willing to upset you. Now, you probably are going to spend those extra 15 minutes because you're statistically likely to behave like other people. But what does that do for you? Well, it leaves you in an angry state. You're not happy. Now, Facebook's happy because they got another 15 minutes of your time, but you're not happy. Likewise, the media that you're served and the ads you're served are not things necessarily that you want. They're things that are being targeted at you because of what the advertiser wants. And so we think that there's a world where you could give basically an invisible agent to every person and let that agent buy and sell your time for you. So look, you're too busy to be bothered with quarter cent here, half cent there, 5 cents for this, 10 cents for that, you know, selling your eyeballs to advertisers and then spending money for little pieces of content like reading news or watching a video or something. But if we gave you an agent and that agent was able to negotiate for you, then you should be better off. So that's the idea with Invisibly. You go to invisibly.com, you sign up. We're effectively going to be doing two things. One is we'll directly pay you for your attention, like money. But more importantly, what we'll do is we'll learn what you want and then on your behalf, negotiate for you with media that you want to consume and things that, you know, and advertisements that you can choose to see or not see.
So I sign up and you pay me, I don't pay you?
Yeah, well, we're effectively your agent. So you don't pay us, we take a cut. You know, we're going to, like I've got an agent. And if he wants to book me on something, you know, and they pay, he takes a percentage of that. But yeah, the idea here is we're going to act on your behalf.
Got it. I'll be there. Jim, I've got a list. I just want to read a few things. You're very active in building the future in St. Louis. You helped start Cultivation Capital, the venture capital firm. You're creating the Now Innovation District in downtown St. Louis. You donated $15 million to Washington University School of Engineering and Applied Science. You co-founded LaunchCode, a nonprofit that partners with companies on paid technology apprenticeships for talented people who lack traditional credentials. And you helped get Square, now Block, to open a St. Louis office that employs more than 850 people. So what's your motivation? What is it about St. Louis?
It's my hometown. I mean, St. Louis, it's a great city, but it's got a lot of problems. And I think one of the problems is tech talent. So LaunchCode gives free education to people who want to become programmers. And free is important because it lets everybody in the door. Now, we don't promise that you're going to graduate. I mean, you got to finish the work, but we're not going to charge you for it. So it's been a fantastic success. Square was a great example of, you know, Jack and I are both St. Louis kids and we wanted to give back to our city. And so we put a big facility there and hopefully a lot of St. Louisans will be working there. And hopefully a lot of people will be coming into St. Louis to work at Block and now be, you know, in this spectacular space around with spectacular people. So I'm trying to do everything I can to help my city be one of the greats.
We're going to take a quick break and then be back with more Midwest Moxie. You're listening to Midwest Moxie on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, and I'm speaking with Jim McKelvey, founder of Square, which is now known as Block, Inc. In 2014, Amazon came at Square by copying its card reader, actually using a black rectangle rather than a white square, and undercutting Square's price by 30%. Very scary. But a year later, Amazon, the most feared competitor in the world, retreated from Square's business. Jim, congratulations on achieving the unusual feat of defeating Amazon. How did you do that?
We didn't know. As a matter of fact, we won, and I was completely mystified as to why. For a couple of reasons. One, we didn't do anything differently. So Amazon came in, as you say, undercut our price, copied our product. And when they do that to a startup, and we were still a startup, the startup always dies. And I mean, always dies. Because I looked when Square was being attacked for other companies that had survived an Amazon attack and found that they were all now either dead or part of Amazon, which, you know, wasn't great. And so then we looked at all the options we had to compete with these guys, and very few. I mean, we weren't as big as Amazon. We didn't have their marketing budget, that we couldn't even afford to price our product in line with what they were charging because it was under our costs. So we had no change of behavior when they attacked us. And yet a year later, they gave up and actually mailed a Square reader to all their soon to be former customers. I mean, it was really amazing how we beat Amazon. Because we didn't do anything, or I should say we didn't do anything differently. So that led me to this sort of conundrum where I was like, what happened? I had to explain it. So that's what led to the book. So I started doing research on other companies that had had this phenomenon. And I figured, you know, surely if you look at history, which goes back an infinite amount of time, there will be other examples. And it turns out that there are dozens of examples, actually hundreds or thousands even, of companies that were tiny little startups who were doing something unique. And then they got attacked by these very, very powerful forces. And in some cases, I'm talking governments, competitors. But in every case, these startups not only survived, but they became the biggest companies in their industry, and in some cases in the world. And so I was like, wow, this is super powerful.
I want to say, you mentioned the book, and I just want to say the name of it because I don't think we've done that. It's called The Innovation Stack, Building an Unbeatable Business, One Crazy Idea at a Time. You know, often when you read business books, you read halfway and go, I got it. I read the whole thing. It's an awesome book.
Oh, thank you. I wrote the whole thing.
Eight times, I think.
Eight times. I should say I rewrote the thing eight times. I tried to not write it. I really tried to not write the book. I tried to hire a ghostwriter. They couldn't do it. I hired another ghostwriter. They couldn't do it. I finally was like, oh, I got to do this all myself. I actually wrote it as a graphic novel. So the book, if you read the book, it kind of reads funny if you're used to business books. And the reason for that is that the first several drafts were pen and ink. They were just cartoons.
Wow.
And the reason the final book is not a graphic novel is because Herb Kelleher, who's one of the guys that I studied and actually met with,
the founder of Southwest Airlines.
The legendary founder of Southwest Airlines. He did not want to be portrayed as a cartoon character. and he said, Jim, I don't think you're doing the right thing. He was like, you're not taking this topic seriously enough, which is funny because Herb was a legendarily funny, hilarious guy. And he basically said, okay, look, now's not the time for joking around. And so, out of respect for Herb, I rewrote the book, and there's not a single cartoon in it. Although, actually, if you go to jimmckelvey.com, you can download for free like some of the cartoon versions of the book. Like, I put those up online. They're still available.
Okay, but here's the thing. When you say innovation stack, I think what I thought initially was, oh, like the business plan, or I didn't understand what an innovation stack was until I read the book, but I bet you can explain it.
Yeah, so an innovation stack is just this mess of things you have to do to solve a problem for the first time. So if you're solving a problem that hasn't been solved before, almost always you're gonna have to not only solve the problem, but you're gonna have to build a bunch of tools. And if you build enough tools, you will find that the tools themselves become sort of interdependent.
So name some of the pieces of Square or Block's innovation stack.
So online sign up, the first, you know, one click sign up, free hardware, flat pricing, you know, super efficient customer service, no contracts, full refunds, like just a bunch of stuff. You listen to that stuff, you go, well, duh, that doesn't sound like a big deal. But it turns out like if you wanted to, so for instance, just to give the customer the ability to know what a charge was going to cost, we had to take this huge financial risk and basically create our own underwriting systems. And then we had to do risk and fraud in a different way because none of the banks would give us their fraud systems because we were doing things differently. So we couldn't use any of their technology. So, you know, it's the same thing with the Wright brothers. You know, they were trying to get an airplane into the air and they needed an engine. Well, the engines were too heavy. You know, you can't have a heavy engine if you're trying to get into the air. So they built an engine out of aluminum, which was, you know, sort of radical and outrageous. It's so much, in fact, that they actually painted the thing black so that, you know, anyone who was spying on them would think it was a normal sort of iron blocked engine, but it turns out that it was made of aluminum. You know, so these are the things you have to do. And if you do enough of them, you build this thing, call it innovation stack, and it gives you a massive competitive advantage, but it also gives you sort of a bunch of different rules, i.e. the things that work for others won't necessarily work for your company and vice versa.
And you believe you beat Amazon because of Square's innovation stack. What I loved in the book is when you talked about the math of that, you know, why a whole innovation stack helps you to beat a big competitor.
Yeah, so let's just do some math simply. Think about the chance of copying something correctly. And just so I can do this in my head, let's say there's an 80% chance, okay? So I've got an 80% chance if I'm copying you that I will do it right the first time. So if I have to copy one thing you're doing, I have an 80% chance of success. If I have to copy two things you're doing, I have a 64% chance of success because it's 0.8 times 0.8 is 0.64. And each time you add another thing, you're decreasing your overall chances of success by 20%. So if you have to copy 10 things, well, now you're down to a fraction, you know, a couple of percentage points. So even mighty Amazon couldn't do 14 things that Square had to do perfectly the first time. And my hypothesis is that that's what led them to quit the business. Now, I'm not an Amazon employee. I wasn't at the meeting where they said, oh God, we got to get out of this. But I am aware of all the stuff that we were doing. And I was also aware of the fact that Amazon wasn't doing all the stuff that we were doing. And at some point, something broke and was probably very painful. My guess, it was the fraud. Because you have to have systems that fight fraud. And we had very sophisticated systems. We had an entire innovation stack for fraud, some of which I didn't discuss in the book. But the bottom line is we knew how to fight that and they might not have.
Well, you also had a much prettier reader, which was honored. You designed that reader and it got put in a museum, right?
The Museum of Modern Art and the Smithsonian both ensconced the Square reader that I helped design, yes.
Yeah, that's awesome. Congratulations. Just one more thing. When Amazon retreated, you mentioned briefly they sent a Square reader to each of their customers?
Yes. I have to say, look, as much as I hated Amazon for what they tried to do to Square, my respect for them quadrupled when I saw how they took care of their customers. Because Amazon, when they quit, weren't going to leave their customers high and dry. These are people who were depending on Amazon to run their businesses and run their charges. And so when Amazon said, look, we want you to have the best system, here, use Square.
And it was Halloween, right?
It was Halloween. It was Halloween 2014 or 2015, I guess. But yeah, it was the best trick or treat I'd ever had.
Jim, let's take a moment here just to hear some of the advice you might have for other entrepreneurs.
So let's start by defining the word entrepreneur. So an entrepreneur, by my definition, is somebody who's in business, but they're not following a known formula. And everybody else that's following a known formula is a business person. And they'll statistically succeed a lot more often than entrepreneurs will. But I think it's important to have this difference because what I discovered is that companies who are entrepreneurial have a different set of problems and almost a different set of physics. Like the rules work differently if you're entrepreneurial. If you're part of an industry where there's sort of an established set of practices and you just have to sort of maintain pace with everybody else, you're probably going to behave and probably should behave much differently than somebody who's in an industry that nobody knows about and they're the only company in it.
Jim, you differentiate between copying and innovating. When should an entrepreneur copy and when should they innovate?
Copy whenever you can. So here's the thing about copying. The reason we copy is because it almost always works better than innovating. And I say that and it's controversial, but if you think about it, look, everyone says they're innovative, but let's think about it this way. If you wanted to be really innovative with your biology, you know, you go out and stand in front of a huge radiation source and it will rearrange your DNA. Now, on one hand, you might be able to become a superhero. Like that's the origin story of every superhero, except Batman. Batman just got rich. But like you could have superpowers, but most likely if you do that, you're just going to get cancer. So what I tell people is, look, if you can find a model to copy and that model is appropriate, by all means copy. And that's always my first move. If I'm trying to do something like this superabsorbent polymer that I'm trying to come up with, I'm trying to copy. I thought somebody already invented it. Turns out they hadn't. Turns out there's some of the basic chemistry isn't working. So it's like, okay, now we have to invent. Now, what are the odds of us being successful? 1 in 10. So invention, innovation, this is a process that is fraught with error and I think should be used as a last resort. But the reason I wrote the book and spent so much time, you know, sort of proselytizing about it is because I want it to be a last resort. In other words, if you find that you are solving a problem that nobody has solved before and you can't copy the solution, what are you going to do? And the answer with most of us is we'll quit. And the reason we're going to quit is that we've spent our entire lives basically in this world where we always had some expert or some education or something we could copy. And that unfortunately won't solve the problems the first time. So I want people to copy if they need to, but also be willing to step across that line and innovate. And it's deeply uncomfortable to innovate, but it is possible.
We are lucky to have you working for the benefit of the Midwest. And thank you so much for taking the time to share your story. Thanks for joining us.
Kathleen, thank you so much. And go Cardinals.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. Midwest Moxie was created by executive producer Audrey Nowakowski and me. Today's episode was produced by Audrey Nowakowski. Join us next Sunday at 7 p.m. to hear from more visionary Midwestern founders building innovative companies. That's right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.